in. Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Getaway Friday morning, April the 7th, 2017, 11:14 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Scott Spears back with you here on the Now program. We're supposed to be joined momentarily by Eleanor Clift, formerly of Newsweek, panelist, longtime panelist on the McLaughlin Group, and currently writer for the Daily Beast, to discuss everything that went on overnight with Syria and what's going to happen with Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch. And then we're going to get back to the conversation we were having with Adam Lepp, who hosts the Adam the Computer Guy show here on WWGH Radio every Tuesday and Thursday morning from 9:10 a.m. until 10 a.m. and discuss music and things of that nature. We have trivia questions. We have the whole bit. So that is the way things are going to trickle down here. We are going to take a quick break and try to get Eleanor Clift again. So don't you dare go away. It's Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, right here on WWGH Radio from 12:10. Listen to the program for guests like these: the Ursula from The Little Mermaid and actress Pat Carroll.
And I think villains are the most fascinating people as an actress to play. They have more edges to them. They have more color to them. Isn't that a shame that goodness isn't more fascinating, or our world would be better?
I guess.
But there is something fascinated about tacky people, mean people. They're colorful. Good people always seem to be a little bit, ugh, yucky. But bad people always have edges to them. That's why they're so wonderful to play for actors.
That?
Because you can. You can pick all the things in life as a human being that annoy you or that you would like to do to be really rotten mean. Most people are too afraid to be rotten mean because we want people's approval so badly. And we know that being rotten mean isn't going to get us that. But, oh, villains for actors are the best things in the world to play.
You know, Pat, that almost describes our current political situation in this country.
Doesn't it just? I'd never thought of that, but you're quite right.
Join me Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio. We'll take your calls, 740-383-9944. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Scott Spears back with you here, 17 minutes past the hour, and last night, if you turned on a television, you certainly had some news. That is, without question, there were, from my understanding, and I could be wrong here, but the last time I checked, there were 50 to 60 Tomahawk missiles, I believe is the proper terminology, that were launched against Syria last night. That's where that stands. And we've also got a Supreme Court justice who possibly is about to be confirmed, not confirmed, because the Supreme or the Senate has gone nuclear. If we don't know what that term is, we're going to try to figure that out. And where are we going in this world? And there's only one lady who can sort all that out for us and give us the intricacies. She is a former panelist on the long-running television series, The McLaughlin Group, and currently with The Daily Beast. So check her out there. One of my favorite guests, one of the most insightful ladies around, Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, boy, oh boy, here's another one, another big day.
Yes. It's a reminder how quickly the narrative of this particular president can change from besieged by scandal, chaos, to now taking a decisive step on the world stage, potentially standing up against the Russians, and we're in a whole other conversation, at least for today, about his presidency and what this action means about the Middle East and the world, and potentially about the remainder of the Trump presidency.
Eleanor, two observations I had last night, and honestly, I knew when the videos came out, I believe it was Tuesday, of what happened in Syria. They were horrible. Anybody who saw them could not be horrified. Videos like that had come out before, but they are horrifying. It was my understanding that the reason President Obama and the Senate and the Congress did not do anything about this in the past was because the country's support was not there. And am I wrong on that? Is that not?
Well, I think the last time we saw similar horrific footage out of Syria was in 2013. And President Obama did think very seriously about retaliating with the same kind of airstrikes that we saw President Trump use last evening. Obama talked about it. I think there was approval in the country. It wasn't overwhelming approval, but the approval was there. And he was going to do it jointly with the Brits. And David Cameron, who was then the prime minister, put it before the parliament in the UK, and they voted it down. And so that made President Obama feel that he needed congressional approval as opposed to going it alone. And they tested the waters on Capitol Hill, and members of Congress did not really want to go on the record one way or the other. They love to talk big, but when it comes to actually voting for military force, they're cowards. And so the votes weren't there, and President Obama backed down, and he was, at the time, we thought he was saved by the Russians. John Kerry helped broker a deal with the Russians that Syrian President Assad would destroy his chemical weapons and or turn them over to the Russians. And that was seen as a win-win for everybody at the time, although obviously they either did not turn over all the chemical weapons they had, or they cooked up some new batches, because they've been waging smaller attacks using poison gas. And the one on Monday, using sarin, was by far the most deadly and debilitating and terrible. And so, I mean, I think President Trump is within his rights to respond. And I think you could even make the argument that if President Obama had followed through in 2013, you know, maybe the picture would have been altered then. I don't want to go that far, because I think President Obama had very many valid reasons for staying out of Syria, and those are reasons that Mr. Trump, then a private citizen, agreed with and tweeted, you know, do not go into Syria. There's no upside and there's lots of downside. Save your powder for another time. Well, maybe this is the other time.
You know, Eleanor, it's interesting, because the narrative I kept hearing last night on the news channels was that President Trump saw this footage, and basically that's what prompted him to do this. Is that the narrative? Is that the truth? Is that why we are where we are now?
I believe that is the truth. This is a man who basically lives on television. I mean, he was part of television. He watches all the shows. He reacts emotionally. I think he did. He saw that footage, and it really got him, as it did to me and a lot of other people. I mean, these are children you saw gasping for breath and actually dying before your eyes. So I think he responded, but I also think the Pentagon has lots of options they can just take off the shelf, because they've been dealing with this situation in Syria for a long time. And I do think probably the military would have liked President Obama to be more aggressive with military action. But in any event, I'm sure it wasn't hard to come up with the options. And according to the reporting, President Trump was presented with three options. He chose one of the lesser ones. I think he rejected the one that would be favored by John McCain, which would be going in and not just going into this one airfield from which the the plane was launched with the poison gas, but to go after all of the airstrips and try to really dismantle the Air Force, the Syrian Air Force. And that would have been, I don't think you could do that without getting buy-in from Congress. That would be really like launching war on another country. And I think he's already going to face some legal questions. And Rand Paul, senator, libertarian senator, is saying what Trump did is illegal. But, you know, I think he acted within the bounds of something that I think President Obama might have done, almost did, and probably would support today as well.
And I think the country, I think if you polled the country, I would imagine, I'm going to say 80% is probably with him. Those videos are horrible, and how many times can we see those? I don't think we can become desensitized to those.
Right. No, I agree. The thing is, it feels like he did the right thing, and I think it's appropriate, it's proportionate, and he has the backing. What comes next? And I don't have full confidence that he or his team have thought that through. Just 10 days ago, they were basically saying it's up to the Syrian people as to Assad's future. They were staying away from any kind of, you know, regime change. I don't know what the policy is now. I mean, actually, what they should do is to go into intense diplomatic negotiations with Russia. Russia is now saying, you know, they're condemning the strikes, and they're saying, you know, they had nothing to do with prompting Assad to carry out that deadly strike anyway. But I would think that Russia on some level might be embarrassed by what Assad has done, and might be looking for a way out. So, this is the time for more diplomacy, I think, not more military action.
Here's what this did for me last night, Eleanor, because I have long, even back through the campaign, felt this way. And this is editorializing, and I want to let everybody know this is a little editorializing on my part, because I think sometimes people drift in between the two without letting the audience know. But Donald Trump is a human being. Like it or not, everything has become so partisan, everything is so negative, and it was negative against Hillary Clinton, who gave her first interview yesterday, which was very interesting. But under all the Russia and under all the comments and the tweets and all that certain people from certain political parties just absolutely despise, and they despise the fact that he won the election, he is a human being. And it's almost like he wasn't. It's almost like he was this terrible, terrible man. And whether you like his policies or not, I hope this puts that to bed. Because I agree with you. I think he's a human being with grandkids and kids who he cares a lot about. And he saw that video. And that 99% of what he did was prompted off of seeing these children treated badly. And whether people agree with him going into Syria to do this or not, or whatever happens after that, you have to say Donald Trump has a heart.
Well, I do think, yes, that his disgust and his fury was legitimate. And we've had this debate about other examples of, you know, television horrors and whether the country should respond militarily. How much policy do you make based on emotion? But, Republicans have been very critical of Democrats for example, going into Libya when Gaddafi was threatening basically the extinction of the population in Benghazi. So humanitarian efforts are frequently mocked by people who say we should only act when national security is at stake. And I thought it was interesting that in his remarks last night, Trump did say that, you know, the national security is at stake. You can't normalize basically the use of these kind of deadly weapons. And so I think he tried to put it in a larger context simply than a humanitarian response. But I think there are probably going to be some people who say, oh, he's done this because his poll ratings are low and he wanted to change the dialogue. I think that's an added benefit for him, but I don't, this is not, you know, Wag the Dog, that famous movie where you create a war so you can improve your poll ratings at home. That I don't believe that for a second. But I do think there's some ancillary benefit here for President Trump. Also, even with the Chinese, he's meeting with the Chinese president, who must be thinking, okay, they pull this off pretty quickly. Are they going to do the same with North Korea? And, you know, what's China's role in trying to prevent that? So I think his decisive action, you know, this early in his presidency, you know, sends a number of messages that are important messages, and that can bolster his standing. He's put down his mark as commander in chief, and it's a strong one.
We pretty well know that what happened last night is not going to put Assad out of business over in Syria. Russia is not happy with it. That was their statement. Do you think that we are going to see ground troops? Do you think this could happen?
You know, I would rule out any substantial, you know, invasion with ground troops. I think maybe, to use the military jargon, he might move to slightly increase the U.S. footprint, maybe more special forces, a handful more troops. I just don't see large-scale American troops wading into the Middle East. That would be so counter to everything he said, and so counter to the America First ideology that he supposedly embraces. And, you know, I think that's true on both sides of the aisle. Wasn't it former Secretary of Defense Gates who said anybody who wages full-scale war in the Middle East again should have their head examined? I mean, I think there are some things we could rule out. There could be more strikes like this. Question is, you know, how useful are they in reaching the end of the war or changing the situation on the ground enough that you could get to negotiations? I think political negotiations, a political end to this, is still got to be the goal.
My understanding has always been, and again, it could be wrong, that Russia is basically allowing Assad to do this. Putin's allowing Assad to do this. Is there any fallout from Russia with this?
I agree that Russia has bolstered Assad. It's Russian air cover that's helping him win the war, and Assad has been winning the war on the ground. That's why it's so mystifying why he would undertake such a grotesque attack when he was winning anyway. And, you know, there's some speculation that Secretary Tillerson's comments about, oh, the Syrian people will decide Assad's future, that was somehow taken as a, you know, green light that Assad should go ahead and finish the job. This was a territory that was held by the rebels, and so I guess he brought civilians in that area as terrorists. But you know, I don't see what Russia stands to gain by having the bloodshed continue. So, and it does help Trump that it now looks like he's at odds with the Russians, because all of the FBI investigation, the investigations on the Hill, have all been about his complicity with Russia. And there has not been any criticism of Russia that's come out in the course of of the last 24, 48 hours. And at the briefing with reporters last night in Mar-a-Lago, I think it was Secretary Tillerson who said, you know, the Russians were not the target here. They even took careful steps to avoid hitting any Russian personnel at that airstrip. I don't know how you go about doing that, but they said they did. And they're saying the target was the airstrip and President Assad for ordering that strike. So they haven't explicitly condemned the Russians. So maybe that's a good thing. Maybe now they can somehow do some sort of negotiating. I mean, that would be the ideal outcome.
Three bits of news before we move on to the Supreme Court here that just kind of got pushed to the side a little bit because of these two much bigger stories. Steve Bannon gets a demotion. Why do you think that happened, and is he on his way out?
Well, I'm not sure he's on his way out. I noticed he was on Air Force One going to Mar-a-Lago, so he's there this weekend. And I think President Trump enjoys his company, but clearly he's been taken down a rung or two, first by General McMaster, who's the National Security Council head, who was given the right to have his own staff and probably had been gunning for Bannon ever since he came to the White House. So I think it's a victory for McMaster. And apparently Bannon has also been at odds with Jared Kushner and the New Yorkers, Gary Cohn, who's the former head of Goldman Sachs, who are seen as more in what we call the globalist camp, whereas Bannon represents this hyper-nationalism, which is basically what got Donald Trump elected. So I wonder how some of the right-wing sites are responding to the fact that Bannon seems to have been edged aside ideologically. But I'm not sure he's out of the picture completely. Trump seems to relish the ongoing chaos around him, beneath him, whatever. And I think he thinks it brings out the best in people. I think that's debatable. But Bannon definitely has been taken down a rung or two. But I think it's premature to say he's out of the picture entirely.
And story number two of the three that kind of got buried a little bit, Devin Nunes, representative, recused himself. Republican representative recused himself from the Russian probe.
Yes, and that was with the acquiescence of Republicans as well as Democrats. I mean, that really was an Inspector Clouseau moment that he had running over the White House and getting information there that he then tried to circulate through the committee. It was bizarre. And so apparently the committee is even investigating the fact that he may have inadvertently or vertently shared some classified material during that whole episode. So he did the right thing. He'd become the story. He'd become the target. The Republicans had lost confidence in him as well. So that was kind of inevitable. Now the question is, can that House committee regain credibility and get back on track, so that you have two investigations on the Hill, the Senate and the House, or will they just completely fall into partisan disarray and leave it to the Senate? So Adam Schiff, who's kind of the star on the Democratic side in the House, clearly would like to get the investigation back on track. It gives him a role and a voice. And so I think they may be able to pull something together again.
And the other, I think, story that kind of got lost because of these two big ones is Hillary Clinton gave her first sit-down interview since her loss in November with a New York Times reporter yesterday. It wasn't on television. People would have to see it on the internet. A lot of clips made it to television. But the big takeaways from that interview seemed to be that she thought she lost the election because of Comey and Russian interference and WikiLeaks. and that she is writing a book all about why she lost the election. And when asked if she would ever run for public office again, she left the door open. She said she found it stimulating and interesting. She didn't think she would, but didn't close the door.
Right. I think she, if there were a clamor for a rematch, and you saw this energy on the Democratic side, look to her as opposed to looking for the next generation. I think she'd be there in a New York minute. But I don't think we're going to see that. So, and, you know, I guess she is a politician in the end, and closing the door entirely makes you less interesting to the people who cover you. So I think she left the door open a crack, but only a very, very small crack. What I thought was interesting, what she said, is that as men get more powerful, they get more likable. And she said the opposite is true for women. And some people have kind of have taken that on and said, well, is that really true or not? I don't think there's a woman who would disagree with that statement. So she was at a women's event sponsored by Tina Brown and the New York Times. And so she was largely talking to an audience of women. And I think they kind of all got where she's coming from. And I think her conclusion about the election, if you changed any one of those three ingredients, the WikiLeaks, the Russian interference, and certainly the Comey coming in 11 days before the election and reopening the email debate, I think we would have had a different outcome. But it does allow her to sidestep areas where she might have fallen short in terms of reading the mood of the American people and relating to the American people. Maybe she'll do that in her book. I think that's probably hard to do for her, as it would be for anyone. And she certainly worked incredibly hard, but there are some things that she shouldn't have done. And I'm not even including the email thing, but the speeches to Goldman Sachs for sums of money was an error in judgment that I don't think she ever recovered from, really, and it opened the door for the Sanders challenge. So I'll be interested to read her book and, you know, how much blame she puts on herself, in addition to these outside factors, which I think, taken together, they were decisive.
You know, the interesting thing that I got from that 45-minute interview, Eleanor, and anybody should watch it, it's all on YouTube, free for anybody to see, was that I've always debated back and forth, would she do it again? Because I think she has a lot of reason to do it again. But the three things that tipped me off in that, writing an entire book on why you lost the last election is certainly a platform, if that book sells well, to get a clamor for you to run again. And the fact she said what she wanted to do was get women into public life, and that she wanted to help the Democrats win back the Congress. That was her focus. I thought that was an interesting answer to get that heavy.
Right.
And then also, in the end, she said she didn't say no. You know, that's what I found interesting.
Right, right, sure. Yeah, and, you know, a whole book on why she lost, it would be better if it had some concluding chapters on what she might have done differently, and if she had the chance, what she would do differently. Then that might be a window into another campaign. But if she actually gets out there and is on the front lines of trying to energize Democrats for in 18 and the midterms coming up, and that's all a very good thing. And if you see her walk into a ballroom of women, I mean, she is a rock star among women. Admittedly, probably women of a certain age. I think young women never quite got her. And, you know, I wish that they didn't turn out in the numbers that that she needed. And, you know, maybe that's kind of understandable. But if people of that generation now step up to run, they will probably understand more of what Hillary Clinton went through, not only in this last election, but in her previous elections and in her whole career. The obstacles that are still out there for women. I think younger women have been somewhat under the illusion that that's all been fixed, but it hasn't. It hasn't at all.
And Eleanor, the other big story, and we're living with it today, right along with Syria, is Judge Gorsuch. Apparently, the Senate has gone nuclear. The Democrats were filibustering. For people who don't understand what has happened, fill them in.
Well, the filibuster has been a tradition in the Senate. It's not in the Constitution, and the Founding Fathers didn't bequeath it to us, but traditionally, for controversial legislation and for Supreme Court judges, the requirement has been 60 votes and not a simple majority of 51. The idea being that that's how you get more of a consensus. Republicans did not reach the 60-vote threshold with Judge Gorsuch, and so they changed the rules to invalidate the use of the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees, which means that he will likely be confirmed today with 55 votes, probably 52 Republicans, and I think there are 3 Democrats who will vote with the Republicans. And Judge Gorsuch, I mean, he's a real judge. He's someone who any conservative Republican president would have nominated. And the anger about him and the efforts to stop him really grow out of the Democrats' anger and frustration that Merrick Garland, who was another real judge with eminent qualifications, who was nominated by President Obama, never even got a hearing. And in almost the entire last year of Obama presidency. And so Democrats regard this as a seat stolen by the Republicans, and there's a lot of animosity that's going to carry over to make a partisan Senate even more partisan. But, you know, the Republicans are so hell-bent on getting him, and when the next vacancy occurs, and it could well occur during Mr. Trump's term, it would likely be a moderate judge or a liberal judge, and that would change the balance of the court. And the Democrats would have clung to that 60-vote threshold, and then the Republicans could have gotten rid of it then. So I think it was inevitable that the Republicans were going to change the precedents and eliminate the 60-vote threshold, because getting their people on the court, it's not like a 4-year win. That's like a 40-year win, and it's very important on to the partisans on the Republican side to have that kind of iron hand on the Supreme Court.
Getting this judge confirmed, does it put anything into jeopardy? Is Roe versus Wade in jeopardy? Is Citizens United possibly going to be overturned? Is same-sex marriage going to go away? Is anything really going to change?
I would take each one of those separately. I kind of think same-sex marriage is be more difficult to overturn. Roe v. Wade hanging by a thread, and I think Citizens United gets upheld with the current makeup of the court. And I think what makes Democrats most nervous about Judge Gorsuch is that he was on a list of judges recommended by the Heritage Foundation. And during the campaign, candidate Trump, promised that he would he would nominate people from this list. And he also said he had a litmus test, and that was Roe v. Wade would be overturned. And so it's quite possible that Gorsuch could take that step, but that the Republicans would still need one more justice, which is why Gorsuch doesn't really change the ideological makeup. He's training in for the Scalia seat. He's probably more conservative than Scalia in some areas and maybe less conservative in others, but it doesn't change the overall balance. But the next seat, if it's Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer, or Justice Kennedy, and they're respectively 84, 78, and 80, I think. So they're getting up to the point where actuarial tables suggest they may look at retirement, or and so there could well be one or more vacancies for President Trump to fill, and that could significantly change the ideological balance of the court.
Do you think that those three judges who you just mentioned, even though they are quite above conventional retirement age, will stay? I mean, we can't prevent when we're going to go when we're in our 80s, but stay in that position because of this, at least to see what happens in the next presidential election.
Yes, and I would say, I would underscore that. I'd have three underscores for Ginsburg, and maybe two underscores for Breyer, and maybe one underscore for Kennedy. Yeah, I think with Breyer and Ginsburg, clearly they would like to wait until there's a Democrat in the White House. And Kennedy, of course, was nominated by President Reagan, so he was nominated by a Republican, and he's more of a swing justice. But Donald Trump is so erratic and unpredictable that Justice Kennedy may also take pause to step down while he's in the White House. I mean, I can't look inside their minds, but I think each of them has incentive to stay as long as their health allows.
Not that there wasn't enough animosity in Washington already, but now after the Senate went nuclear, what is the feeling going to be between Democrats and Republicans?
It's an era of bad feeling. I would have thought it couldn't get worse. It will get worse, but maybe only marginally so. I think that the Democrats are reconciled to the fact that the Republicans were gonna do this with Supreme Court nominations at one point or another, because the court is so important to them. I think the next hurdle is keeping the filibuster on legislation, and the Republicans could well change the rules with legislation if they're having trouble getting through Trump's major initiatives. And so I think that's what Democrats are worried about next. And there probably will be some efforts to reform the filibuster. For example, they shouldn't just allow any senator to call a filibuster. They should have to stand up and talk. And I thought Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, although what he did wasn't part of the official filibuster, he held the floor for 15 hours. And that's the way the filibuster used to be done in the old days. And it was rarely used, and not always for the most heroic purposes. That's how the Southern senators blocked civil rights legislation, you know, for years. So it's not necessarily a heroic gesture, but it is a tool for the minority. And if they took that away for legislation, the Republicans, if they could ever get their act together, could pass just about everything they wanted. And from the Democratic perspective, that's pretty scary.
All the talk on the talk shows this morning, because it certainly was Syria, but a lot of the narrative of the conversation this morning was that Congress has not declared war since 1942, and they are the ones who are supposed to do this. Why hasn't Congress declared war since 1942, and is that just a quaint idea now that's forever gone?
They haven't because it's so much easier to let the executive shoulder that burden, and members of Congress talk big, but they rarely, as that date you cited speaks for itself, they rarely want to take a vote on it because it might not play well in their district. Remember the authorization, it wasn't declaring war, but the authorization for George H.W. Bush, the first Bush, to go into the Persian Gulf. A number of Democrats voted against that, and then it turned out to be a successful venture and kind of backfired on those who opposed it. So then when the Sun comes forward with the authorization to go into Iraq, a lot of Democrats, remembering they'd voted wrong the first time, then supported going into Iraq, and that came back to bite them, notably Hillary Clinton, who lost her first bid for the presidency in part because she had supported going into Iraq. So members of Congress, I mean, there are already a lot of profiles of courage. A lot of them are holding the finger to the wind and trying to figure out where public opinion is. So they just as soon avoid that responsibility. But what you have today is Senator Kaine, former vice presidential candidate with Hillary Clinton, he's quite outspoken on the fact that the Congress really needs to weigh in on this. And then on the Republican side, Rand Paul has said that what Trump did is illegal and that he needs to come to the Congress. I suspect it'll just be a war of words. I don't think they'll actually take a vote, except if the Trump administration really decides that they're going to substantially deepen the U.S. presence in Syria and they're going to widen the war, I think then they probably will need congressional backing. But that would be a major undertaking. They'd have to whip the votes, and I think they could get it for this strike because it's an emotional response. But if they want to go back and really expand the war or have some follow through, I don't think you're going to see a lot of members of Congress, you know, rushing to put their name on the record for what this president might want to do.
Final question, Eleanor. I was watching, and it was Morning Joe this morning, and there's talk that President Trump might be looking for a new chief of staff, and on somebody's paper, it was Jared. Of course, that's Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. Does that look likely?
Being Jared, in addition to everything else he's doing, becomes the chief of staff? In moving aside Rince Priebus, it's almost become comical that every job falls to Jared. And what that, I mean, I don't know him. I hear he's a brilliant young man, but he's been charged with, bringing about peace in Iraq. He heads the opioid council. He has been announced as the head of the new innovation office. These are all full-time jobs. So making him chief of staff in addition to everything else, or I think he's chief of everything, apparently. Everything goes through him. If you're a foreign leader and you want to set up a visit with the president, you go to Jared. This president doesn't trust a whole lot of people, and being chief of staff is a very, very demanding job, and maybe that's what he's doing already. I just hope if they give him that one, I hope he gets a good staff so he has some people to work with him. The bare bones staff that this president has is it's like the campaign, and we all said, can't win, it's not a real campaign. Look at Hillary's campaign, she has people doing this, that, and the other thing, and Trump had a few apparent hangers-on, and of course they won. And now he's running the White House just like he ran the campaign, with a handful of people that he trusts, and with chaos all around, which he seems to enjoy.
It's always interesting. Eleanor Clift from the Daily Beast, yeah. Thank you okay. so much. We appreciate it. Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
And we only have about 30 seconds left. Don't forget the Exchange Club coming up next here in about 10 minutes, so don't you dare change your dial. Then the Fahey Bank Charlie Evers Show from 1:15 today until 3 p.m. Lots of great giveaways, Lee's Famous Recipe, McDonald's, and anything else we can find. I think we have some insulated mugs from CRT, maybe some Jags hats, so stay tuned. We're going to take a little bit of a break here, 10 minutes, and back on the other side, WWGH Radio. You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP, Marion, Ohio. The voices you want to hear. From Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
What is something, because it's years later now, that would have been a